Running outside of the formal party structure may seem a bit more common now, but when incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski lost the primary in 2010, then bucked party leaders to run an independent write-in campaign for the general election, it made headlines. She prevailed in that race, but she's again facing her formal rival, plus a few new ones. What will she focus on if Alaskans vote to send her back to Washington? We'll find out when Senator Lisa Murkowski joins us today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Senator Lisa Murkowski is an attorney and has served in the U.S. Senate for Alaska since 2002. Senator, welcome.
Good morning. Good to be with you, Lori.
Thanks so much for being here. I know that's pretty hectic in the lead up to the election. If you have questions for Senator Murkowski, you can call in statewide 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Senator Murkowski, you've been to Kodiak, to Fairbanks, to Utqiagvik, formerly known as Barrow, for debates, forums. As you've been taking part in these debates and campaigning in this particularly vitriolic campaign election cycle, what stands out to you regarding concerns that Alaskans have come forward with in the lead up to the general election?
Well, it's not just been the communities that we visited for the debates. It has been all over the state. In the past couple years here, I've visited close to 150 different communities, from the big rail belt communities to the smallest village out on the coast. And that's just part of what I do. It's probably the best part of what I do is being out there and listening to Alaskans, engaging with them on the issues that are first and foremost, going into their homes, going visiting with their kids in the schools, and talking about their concerns. There's a few issues that kind of follow through wherever it is that you go. It's energy costs. As Alaskans continue to deal with high energy costs, that's a subject of discussion, most certainly. But we're also hearing concerns about high healthcare costs, particularly at this time of year, as we're seeing people get notices of their increased premiums. So healthcare is truly an issue that is first and foremost out there. But it's also a concern about what we're seeing with drugs coming into communities, the rising rates of heroin coming in. And again, not here just in Anchorage, but out in Bethel, in Dillingham, in small villages, the concern about drugs, alcohol, and then in many of those parts of the state, the concern about public safety, how we deal with this. So when you think about the issues that Alaskans are talking about, it's pretty basic stuff. It's keeping warm, which is energy. It is concern about their families when it comes to health care and issues like drugs. And then, of course, there's always the common tie, and that's a discussion about fisheries, because fisheries is so much a part of our economy. The kind of overall, the overlay on all of this, though, is what is going on with the state's budget and how that impacts our communities, what they're seeing in terms of the level of state support. And so my role really at the federal level is to try to help help offset some of what we're seeing right now at the state level with serious reductions in state funding? What is it that we can do at the federal level to help offset that, whether it is what we've been doing to help with national security and bring in military construction dollars, particularly up in the interior, whether it's a multi-year highway bill that we were successful in advancing just in March, and again, making sure that we have a way to access more of our resources up north so that we can help fill up that pipe. So the concerns that Alaskans have are really more localized in nature to our state as opposed to kind of the big national broader discussion out there.
Well, let's stay on the especially rural Alaska theme for just a moment. The Alaska Federation of Natives Convention was just recently wrapped up. You were there. And a big topic of conversation has, of course, been the tribes in Alaska having the way sort of cleared for them to apply for land into trust. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about what this could mean going forward, especially as it relates to the potential for law enforcement in rural Alaska and a changing kind of relationship, maybe a more direct path between tribes and the federal government? What will that look like if it's successful?
Well, and this is where I think there is still so much uncertainty as to what exactly land into trust means in Alaska. As we know, in Alaska for years now, land into trust has not been, basically it's not been an option that is on the table. That now, as you have said, that path has been cleared, but what does it mean? Because mm-hmm. we don't have Indian country. Outside of Metlakatla, we don't have Indian country here. So how does that translate? I have tried to press the administration to have a better understanding, because I think there are many here in the state who believe that if we move land into trust, that somehow or other that brings federal dollars into the mix, which when you are looking to resource public safety, whether it's additional VPSOs or getting additional resources out to provide for help in many of the villages, it's important to know, are these federal dollars coming? Well, I can tell you that very directly, as I have asked administration representatives, whether they are with the Department of Interior or whether they are with Justice, the response that I'm getting back is no, this does not mean that there will be additional funds that come to Alaska. As you know, we are a PL 280 state, which means that it is on the state to provide for that level of public safety. So I want us to know, I want us to have eyes wide open with this as to what exactly it will mean. And I think the conversation that was had at AFN was actually quite constructive because it brought out some of the uncertainty, much of the questions that still remain about land into trust and what that will mean for us. So I am encouraging a real robust discussion amongst not only our Alaska Native leadership, but with the state and our federal officials to say, okay, let's be honest about what this brings. We in so many areas are almost desperate for some level of support. I have worked to try to help facilitate funding for our tribal courts. For the first time ever, our tribal courts will receive funding coming out of DOJ money. And it's not a lot. We got $10 million in the first round and $10 million in the second, which is, you know, we're getting our foot in the door there, which I think is helpful. But again, we need to be realistic about what does land into trust really mean here in a state where Indian country does not exist outside of Metlakatla.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and our guest today is incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski. You can join the conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, that's statewide. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to the phones. Jim is in Fairbanks. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, Senator, this is Jim in Fairbanks. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling to question you about the riders that you've attached to the Senate Appropriations Bill for the Interior Department that guts the new rules for the wildlife refuges and, I think, the national parks.
And what's your question?
I want to ask her about these.
Well, what I can tell you is that I have included in the appropriations bill that is pending before the Senate now a provision that would ensure that here in Alaska, we have the ability to manage our game on our refuges. As you probably well know, Fish and Wildlife has, to use the word lightly, intervened in areas where I think most of us in the state would say that the management that has been provided by law to the states is being encroached and infringed upon. And so I have included language that makes clear that the state role is appropriate and needs to be respected. And this is one of those areas where I have joined many, many Alaskans in expressing the concerns that I have with the federal government and our agencies moving in an area of jurisdiction that goes beyond what they are authorized as a federal agency.
All right,
yeah,
Jim.
Well, as I hope you understand, the support for the new rule has been substantial in this state, and the state has mismanaged with extreme predator control, baiting bears over, snaring bears, digging bears out of dens, aerial shooting of wolves. This is egregious and it's extreme. So I just want you to think about this, and I want you to consider dropping those riders because they're very damaging, and the ANILCA did not permit the state to operate in this fashion. This is what this is all about. So I'm pleading with you to give a little more consideration and drop the riders.
Jim, I appreciate your concern, and I know exactly the specific issues to which you have addressed, and they are very specific. I have looked at this assertion of jurisdiction and said this is just representative of the bigger problem. We as Alaskans in the state need to figure out how we directly manage, and we know we have had our battles most certainly when it comes to predator control and again how we manage as a state. But I hear your concerns and I thank you.
All right, thanks for the call, Jim. Let's go back to the phones. I was hoping for, here we go. Oh, we lost somebody there. All right, let's go to Mike in Kodiak. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Good morning, everybody. Senator, you were there in 2003, junior senator, when 8 Republican senators voted against opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Now, Hillary Clinton has picked her transition chief, which is Ken Salazar, a man who convinced President Obama to expand gun rights in national parks and work with Senator Begich to open oil drilling in the Arctic. Now, we've got a transition that's ready to open federal oil leases. There's more oil than just in Anwar in Alaska, and help fill the pipeline. Yet you've stated anybody but Hillary, you can't work with Hillary Clinton. How are you going to work with Ken Salazar when you've stated that you can't?
Well, I think I need to make clear to you, Mike, and to everyone that's listening, I will work and have worked with whomever our president is, whether it is President Clinton or whether it is President Trump. My reality is, as your senator, I will work with our president, because that is what is expected. I have done so with the Obama administration, not only working with the president. I will oppose him when I feel necessary, and I certainly do so. But you have to work with the administration that you have, even if it's an administration that is not my choosing. And I recognize this. Part of the accusation I've actually received over the years as senator is that you're willing to work with both sides. Well, yes, in fact, I believe that is the role of a legislator, of a policymaker. You have to work with those who have differing viewpoints. You don't put aside your principle, but you do work to collaborate and to facilitate legislation. This is what bipartisanship is all about, and it's what I have built my reputation on, is working to advance the interests of Alaska. So, and as it relates to Ken Salazar, I served with Ken Salazar when he was in the Senate. He and I actually helped to advance some pretty good things on the Energy Committee. He and I crossed swords a little bit, because he was the first one that I think turned a blind eye to the people of King Cove as we were trying to help facilitate that exchange. I was very disappointed in that, but Ken Salazar is certainly somebody that I can work with. And again, regardless of who the next administration is, my first task will be to make sure that everyone on that transition team and any nominees that would come before us for approval, that I make sure that they understand the issues of Alaska, whether it's, again, things like fisheries, energy costs, the impact of healthcare on our families, the Alaska-specific issues related to access, the impact of regulations on a state that, again, isn't connected to the lower 48. So making sure that they fully understand the issues and concerns of all of Alaskans.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for that call. Let's stay with the phones for just a few minutes here. We've got callers stacking up. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and our guest today is Senator Lisa Murkowski. Let's go to Andrew in Dutch Harbor. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Good. Did you have a question for Senator Murkowski?
Yes. Hey, Lisa. How's it going?
Pretty good.
Now, I live in Dutch Harbor. I'm a commercial craft fisherman and also a recreational gold miner in the Coldfoot-Wiseman area. Now, I know there's a lot of miners that are shut down. There's over 400 miners that are shut down with BLM, Tim Hammond, Timothy Lamar, and your buddy, Sally Jewell. So what are you going to do to put the pressure on Sally Jewell to open up that road for King Cove, because you know it's in your 43 CFRs, and it's up to her. And what are you going to do to open up this land for gold miners, which is, I mean, it's every right for us to mine. Why are they shutting us down? What's going on with you in Washington? And I wish you did not publicly denounce Trump. I'm voting for Miller on this one. I'm sorry I voted for you before, but I'll take my questions off the air. Bye.
Well, Andrew, thanks. Two very important questions. First, on King Cove. That is an issue, again, that I have been leading the charge now for years. And whether it is the legislation that we were successful in passing. In fact, it was President Obama who signed the legislation that would allow for that exchange to go forward. Sally Jewell unilaterally rejected it, and we have been battling her ever since. And when I say that we have been continuing that battle, it is, again, advancing additional legislation that would allow for an exchange that the state is then able to facilitate. We not only have introduced it, we've had a hearing on it. It has moved out. It has moved through the committees, and it is effectively teed up to be advanced in another vehicle as we try to move that forward. you know, when you think about those things that those votes that you regretted, my biggest regret is that I actually thought that Sally Jewell, having had a little bit of experience in Alaska in the early days with Red Dog, that she might have some appreciation and understanding of some of our concerns, and she has been just a horrible disappointment, and she is one vote that I regret providing my support to. Now, neither here nor there, she's going to be gone here shortly, and that will be good for us, but my push to get that road open to provide for safety for the residents of King Cove is one that will remain as aggressive as it has been. On our small miners and the pushback they're getting from BLM, this is, again, something that I have been in the lead on. What we're seeing out there is BLM effectively coming to those that are living and working out in these very remote areas, whether it's in the Coldfoot area, as you indicated, Andrew, or whether it's the folks out in 40 Mile. BLM has put forward this proposal that puts into effectively a de facto wilderness. They don't call it wilderness. They call it areas of critical environmental concern, ACECs. Nobody had even heard of these designations but for a couple years ago. But it effectively is an end run around Anilka. When we said in Anilka that Alaska, with all of the wilderness that was designated at that time, that there would be no more wilderness in Alaska absent a congressional approval. Well, so what they're doing is they're not designating wilderness, they're designating something new. They're using words to get around the law. Well, we've said, no, you can't do that. And in the Interior Appropriations Bill, the subcommittee that I chair, I've included language that provides that any ACECs that have been designated will be basically removed, that we will not advance those going forward. It again, to me, is one way in which the executive is skirting the law, skirting the intent of Anilka. I've also got language in a bill that makes sure that Anilka is no more. I mean, that we have a clause in the legislation that says no more means no more, and puts a limitation on the executive branch in their ability to, again, create wilderness by calling it something other than wilderness. Establishing de facto wilderness by renaming it something else is in violation of Anilka, and we state so very clearly. That legislation, again, is not just something that we put down on paper. We've actually moved it through the committee. And so, again, in terms of what it is that we are doing to advance these issues and to protect the intent here, has been substantial.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is our guest today for Talk of Alaska. I want to get to an email question. This is dealing with climate change, mm-hmm. from Catherine and Kay says, what solutions are you proposing to solve the problem of ocean acidification and warming, especially acidification and permafrost melt? So dealing with the issue of climate change,
which is a big issue around our state and lot of concern and discussion, particularly in our coastal communities as they are seeing impact, whether it's due to coastal erosion, earlier storms. Our reality is that we're seeing the impacts of climate change out there. In terms of what we're doing about ocean acidification, you know, first of all, we need to understand what it is that we're dealing with, making sure that we are resourcing the science and the data behind it. I am the co-chair of the Senate Oceans Caucus. The very first caucus that we held of our Senate colleagues. I was working with my co-chair, Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island, and he said, "What do you think our first issue should be?" And I said, "Let's start with ocean acidification. It kind of goes to so much of the heart of what we're seeing and recognizing that our oceans comprise about 70% of planet Earth. This is important. So what are we doing? Let's understand the science." So we brought in the head of the University of Alaska Ocean Acidification Center, Dr. Jeremy Mathis, who is really the most renowned expert on this, to just kind of understand what is it that we know at this time. And this was about 3 years ago by now that we had this first caucus on this. And since then, we have, again, been focusing on where are we with understanding what we're seeing. What are the impacts? Let's make sure that we are not just guessing and hoping we get this right, but what are we doing with the funding? So working with NOAA to make sure, again, that they have the resources that they need for the research, making sure that within our federal agencies, working with our state agencies. And again, when I mentioned at the outset, part of what I'm trying to do now is, on the state side, we're seeing some pretty dramatic cuts to budgets. And we know that also comes with some of the data collection side. We can't afford to lose that. So making sure that we're putting the resources where we need is going to be important. There's been a lot of discussion about, well, climate change and the impacts. How do you kind of keep Mother Nature away from communities like Kotzebue that has built up a pretty substantial retaining wall? Unalakleet needs better revetment. Up in Barrow, there's threats to their infrastructure from the fall storms. How do you reinforce this? How do you move a village like Newtok or Kivalina or Shishmaref? Incredibly expensive. How do we deal with the impacts when the reality is it takes money, and it takes a lot of money? There's a lot of people that say, well, you know, you just have this coastal resilience fund. That was the president's plan. Unfortunately, the president's plan didn't fund it from a source that was going to be meaningful. He basically said, we'll just take the money from the Gulf of Mexico and their revenue sharing. Well, you want to start a fight with everybody in those Gulf states about allocation of those resources that have already been allocated to those states, and say we're going to claw that back, it's going to be pretty tough. So what I have proposed, and what we've laid out there, and we've actually had committee hearing and moved it through committee, is a revenue sharing proposal that new revenue from offshore or onshore will be distributed to Alaska, as well as Atlantic states that also host offshore development. But then part of that revenue sharing would consist of what we call a tribal resilience fund. And from that tribal resilience can be the resource base for whether it is shoring up eroding coastline, moving communities, helping for evacuation routes, dealing with the stressors that the mental health issues that, mm-hmm. that come with this. So it's pretty wide in its application, but it would come from actual resources. If we're allowed to develop these areas offshore and then again new onshore, then you have a source of funding rather than something imaginary or just kind of pie in the sky. We're going to wish that it's going to come.
All right. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Senator Lisa Murkowski as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Our guest today is Senator Lisa Murkowski. We have a whole lot of phone calls lined up and a lot of email questions. But I want to get to a couple of things first before we go back to the phone lines. I wanted to get your thoughts on some current national issues. Mm-hmm. Do you think it was the correct course of action for FBI Director James Comey to come forward regarding this current email concern at this point in time with the election?
Yes. You know, Director Comey is in a hard place. I think we would all recognize that. But I want to believe, as I'm sure Director Comey wants to believe, that the FBI is tasked with a level of investigation that is unbiased, that is free of political influence. And if he were to have just sat on this, knowing that there is this potential for implication of Secretary Clinton, it would have completely eroded the credibility of the FBI going forward. Now, it's been suggested that it is unprecedented that the FBI would come forward this close to an election, and that somehow or other it is politically motivated. You know, think about Director Comey. The safest place for him to go would just be to sit down and shut up. I think he made the most difficult decision. My hope is that the FBI moves as expeditiously as they possibly can. I think it's interesting to note that not only have you seen expressions of concern about, hey, let's get this information out quickly from Democrats in both the House and the Senate, but now Chairman Grassley, who's Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee, has said it's imperative that we get to the public as quickly as possible. And I think the deadline that they've set on this is the 4th, which a couple days from now, which I think is important. But I do think that it was for the credibility of the FBI and the integrity of the FBI, it was important once they learned something to immediately make it known. I wish that they had more substance that they could give us right now.
Yes.
But in fairness, I think it was incumbent upon Comey to make the statement that he did.
Well, let's stick with a national issue. I've got a couple calls here and on this issue, and it was something that I wanted to ask about as well, which is the Supreme Court vacancy.
Mm-hmm.
You had said in the past that you felt that Judge Garland should get at least a hearing, I believe.
Yeah.
Maeve is on the line from Anchorage that has a question about the Supreme Court.
Sure.
Hi.
Hi. Good morning, Senator Murkowski.
Morning.
Good morning. So I was interested to hear you state earlier that you are willing to work with the president regardless of party affiliation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of your job responsibilities as a U.S. senator involves conducting hearings on judicial nominees, including nominees for the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
I am wondering why you have not pushed for a hearing for President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland for the open position on the U.S. Supreme Court.
I had said initially when Justice Scalia passed that there's a process in the Senate for how we move forward with advice and consent on nominees. The president nominates, the Senate engages in that advice and consent. And that advice and consent comes when there is a hearing before the Judiciary Committee. I'm not on the Judiciary Committee, but I am a chairman. And as a chairman, I understand what Chairman Grassley did in saying that he was not going to hold confirmation hearings. Not only did he make that as the chairman, but his committee, the Republicans on the committee, I need to make clear on that, the Republicans on that committee backed him and said, okay, the chairman has said he's not going to be holding hearings. He is going to allow the next president to make that determination. I respect that was the will of the chairman, and that's where we are right now. There has not been a process coming out of the Judiciary Committee, and my hope is that we will have an opportunity quickly in this next year to move forward on the role of advice and consent to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court left by Justice Scalia.
All right, well,
could you clarify, though? I've been struggling to come up with...
Uh-oh. I don't know what happened there. We lost a couple callers at the same time, apparently. So sorry about that, but let's move on to another issue.
Okay.
How much time do you have left as chairman of the Senate Energy Committee if Republicans retain control of the Senate?
If Republicans retain control, I have an additional 4 years. Under the Republican rules in the Senate, committee chairmen are limited to a six-year period. It doesn't have to be consecutive, but it's 6 years total. I have served six as the ranking member. Hard to believe already, but I've been six as the ranking member, and so I will have completed two at the end of this year.
All right. Well, that kind of goes hand in hand with a question about energy and one of the email questions that we had about proposing this caller or email question from Peggy in Soldotna. She wants to know, how do you propose to move from burning coal and oil to solar, tidal, and wind power? She's looking at this transition for renewable energy. Where's the mix, and where do you think we need to be in the next 5, 10, 20 years as far as renewable versus fossil fuels?
Well, I am pretty aggressive in saying that there needs to be forward movement in all areas. I am one who says, look, we've got an abundance of coal in this country. So how are we going to access that so that we have the resource, the jobs that come with it, but do so in a way that is not harmful to the environment? So how do we advance the technologies that allow us to get to reduced emissions through cleaner coal? And so technology with our fossil fuels is really the way of the future in terms of what we do with our renewables. And this is where I am very bullish about the leadership role here in Alaska, because when you want to talk about a state that truly has it all, we have it all. We know we've got all the fossils, but we also have all the renewables. And what we're doing, how we're pioneering when it comes to microgrids, these smaller communities that will never be part of anybody's larger grid, how are we taking advantage of the resources that are right there and pulling them together so that they can power a community? And it's taking a few wind turbines, you combine it with a river turbine, you connect it to some solar in the village, and all of a sudden you have a community like Igiagig that was 100% on diesel, and now they're only 50% on diesel. Well, you say, well, they're still 50%. Well, when you take into account that they're paying $9, $10 a gallon for that diesel, diesel is not sustainable, and it's not environmentally where we want to go. So what we're doing in terms of the pioneering with renewables in Alaska becoming that test case for everywhere else, not only in the country, but in the world. And think about it. It's 33,000 miles of coastline. Think about harnessing the power of the tides and the differential between the temperatures in the water. We're seeing some interesting pioneering going on there. But it's all of the marine hydrokinetic. It's the geothermal potential that we have all up and down the Aleutians here in South Central. It is our opportunities further for wind and for solar, but also for biomass that has great potential, not only down in our rainforest down in the Tongass area, but the potential that you have with biomass with the small willows up in the interior. It is really an abundance of riches when it comes to renewable energy. And oftentimes Alaskans don't think of our state as leaning forward when it comes to solar. The intensity that we get, even during the winter when we've got those daylight hours, we can harness this. And again, given our high energy costs, if we can figure out how to make these smaller systems work in a place, in a high-cost place like Alaska, you can make it pencil just about any place else.
And what do you see as the federal government's role in that very issue? You've mentioned a couple of times that the state is having budget trouble, and that's going to really especially impact rural Alaska. Yep. What is the federal government's opportunity or responsibility or role in helping to create and stimulate some of those jobs in renewable energy that could be happening in Alaska?
Because, you know, when you look at some of the subsidies that are put in place, these are not sustainable themselves. And so you need to have these technologies that can kind of stand on their own. But there is that federal role to kind of help facilitate these technologies so that they can get out of beyond this incubator stage
R&D.
And to commercialization. And this is where you have entities like ARPA-E, which is basically that energy think tank incubator type of an agency where we're actually seeing some of these new developments that can come out that, again, we don't want the government to be the one taking it into commercialization, but working with our national labs, for instance. You know, you have extraordinary expertise in the innovation going on there. This is the same approach that we've taken within the defense world, where we've seen such an amazing development in the technologies that have allowed us to be really that defense superpower. Well, we're now doing that within the energy space as well. And I think that's where your appropriate role is at the federal level. One of the things that I'm excited about within our energy bill that is in conference now, it would, if we're able to pass this in this next month or so when we go back, this will be the first energy reform that we have seen in this country in almost 9 years now. And this is something that I've been working on with Senator Cantwell for the past year and a half. And it is substantive. But one of the pieces in there that is good for us as a state is something that we call a state energy assistance. And it would allow states to be able to tap into federal loans to help facilitate energy infrastructure and investment through our state programs like the Alaska Energy AEA, Alaska mm-hmm. Energy Assistance.
All right, let's go back to the phones again. This is another rural Alaska issue.
Okay.
Dale is in Caltag and has a question about bypass mail. Hi, mm-hmm. Dale.
Good morning, and good morning, Senator Murkowski.
Good morning.
Bypass mail has been a problem here, and I guess other places too, when I talk with other store owners. And we're a cooperative here. We have to live like a third world country out here because we are basically at the mercy of the air services. We used to have two carriers out of Fairbanks. Now we have one. We continuously, when we get bypass, we get other people's bypass. Our stuff turns up missing. We haven't had any bread or eggs in this town for 2 weeks now because the air service decided not to bring it down. I don't exactly know why. They do whatever they feel like. The post office, you call, you get a recorder, and you never get a call back. It's frustrating. We have to live like third world country because we can't get the stuff. We can't get healthy stuff for our kids to order fresh fruit and stuff that won't come in for 2 or 3 weeks and is rotten when it gets here. There's a bypass mail system in place, but the post office and the air services refuse to do anything to keep up with it.
Well, thanks for the call, Dale.
Dale, I appreciate you calling in this morning, and this is actually something that after I get done here, I'll visit with my folks here and make some calls about what exactly is happening out in Caltag and in the region there with bypass. You know, I think it's fair to say that you know, bypass mail works exceptionally well in certain areas and is viewed as absolutely necessary in order to help offset the high cost of living in so many villages, so many parts of the state of Alaska. This is a program that's been in place since Senator Stevens put it in years and years ago. And some on the outside just have no idea why we would even have bypass mail and say, well, this is something that just doesn't make sense. It doesn't happen anywhere else. Well, in the lower 48, you don't have any state that is in a situation where 80% of their communities are not accessible by road. And in the winter months, not accessible by barge. So our reality is it's just different up here than it is anywhere else. It is higher cost, and we try to work to reduce the cost. And it actually, bypass mail is something that actually saves the post office money. And this has been an important part of the service to Alaskans. So we want to try to get it right. It is difficult. It's difficult to get out into so many areas, particularly when weather is good and carrier service is not reliable. The post office, in an effort to reduce costs, has sought to make changes to bypass in terms of consolidation of certain routes. And I continue to hear concerns about either late deliveries or no deliveries. So we try to stay on it as much as we possibly can to make sure that that in an effort to gain efficiencies, we're not really eroding the commitment and the promise to service for Alaskans out in these areas. So, Dale, I appreciate you calling in and know that we'll get on the situation there in Caltag and hopefully have things working a little bit better for you. But I appreciate the heads up.
Thanks for the call, Dale. No eggs, no milk or bread in Caltag for 2 weeks. That's no good.
That's no good.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Senator Lisa Murkowski as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
It's no secret that salmon is important to Alaskans. It brings us together across communities, cultures, and economies. Discover what you can do to ensure healthy runs of salmon for generations to come by visiting salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're going to go back to the phones because we have a lot of callers. Tom is in Anchorage. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Murkowski, holding the position of opposing abortion, it is logical that there, if your side gets its way and makes abortion illegal again, that there would be punishment for violating this new law, and I was curious as to what you think the schedule should be for the woman who obtains the abortion, the provider, the nurse, the receptionist down the hall. I know this is something that politicians don't want to answer, but it's a logical outcome of reenacting a 100-plus-year-old law that was repealed 40 years ago.
Well, it would not be the Congress that would change the law on abortion. It would have to be the United States Supreme Court. And so I think it's important that we recognize that, that in fact the courts have ruled in Roe versus Wade that abortion shall be provided and made legal. There are exceptions that the court allowed and provided for in Roe versus Wade. I think you've seen some of those enacted, or the limitations enacted through Congress, certainly a ban on partial birth abortions. In terms of punishment to a woman who sought abortion services, absolutely not permissible, or even something that I would consider thinkable.
Let's go back to the phones. We're going to try and get through some calls very quickly. Susan is in Fairbanks. Hi, Susan. Your question, please.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to ask, make a comment and ask a question of Lisa. I think that the Park Service provides quite a bit to our economy now. For example, I've read that last year we had 2.66 million visitors to Alaska's National Park Service lands, and they spent nearly $1.2 billion in the state. And the Park Service also provides 17,000 jobs, and a total of $1.7 billion was brought in by the Park Service. And I'm wondering, well, a lot of visitors come to photograph wildlife in wild landscapes, and I'm wondering why Lisa Murkowski would jeopardize that tourism economy by allowing continuing killing of wolf pups and mothers in dens, which would occur if they nullify the National Park Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service new sport hunting regs. And Denali Park has lost two of its wolf packs that were regularly seen along the road. And those were wolf packs that were breeding members that were killed by being attracted to hog baiting stations. They were.
Susan, let's let the senator answer. We've got only a couple minutes left. I want to get a couple more questions in here. So go ahead, Senator.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that certainly within Denali, you don't have, within the main park itself, hunting is not allowed.
It's illegal.
It is illegal. There are certain perimeter that have perimeter issues that have been under discussion for some time. I think Susan raises a good point, though, in terms of the value of tourism that is brought because of our significant national parks, not only in the interior, but really around the state, making sure that our parks are maintained, that they are the attraction that we want them to be is important. I am the chairman of the Interior Appropriations Committee, and I'll tell you, one of my big concerns is the fact that we seem to be spending a lot of money by the agencies to purchase additional lands to create new parks, and yet we have a maintenance backlog on our parks that is extraordinary and has been left unattended. This is actually something that I've been trying to work on in addressing how we deal with maintenance and backlog, because whether it is the road going into the park or making sure that there's just simply outhouses that are maintained and clean, so that they're able to be used by people, but not attracting animals either. It's just, these are some issues that I think when we look at what it is that we can do to help our parks, we make sure that before we spend a lot of money adding new parks to the system, that we're making sure that we're putting the investment in our existing beautiful parks that we really treasure.
We only have about a minute and a half left, and I wanted to get to a question, I will be sending these emails on to your staff.
Great, thank
so
you.
That people can, because there's a lot of emails that came in. The question from one emailer today about his health insurance rates going up 372%, he says. What do you think should happen? Would you advocate for repealing the Affordable Care Act? Would you advocate for just making changes to the existing structure? What do you think needs to happen going forward?
I have voted against the ACA every time I had an opportunity to, and voted to repeal that. We put that before the president. Of course, there was no action on that. Understandably, this is his signature initiative. But our reality is we did not make health care affordable with the ACA. We required people to have insurance. And so now this caller, this writer, is looking at these increases. So what we have to do is we have to make sure that we have addressed the healthcare cost side, the delivery side. It's one thing to require people to have insurance, but if the insurance is not affordable, unless you're going to subsidize everybody, which is not something that I'm supportive of, you cannot address the healthcare system by just focusing on the insurance side. So we need to repeal so much of what has caused the increase. The fact that we don't have any choice here in Alaska right now is part of our problem. The fact that you have essential aspects of the law that are required, whether or not that's appropriate for you and your family. The fact that we have in a small population state like Alaska no ability to spread the risk here. The fact that there's no transparency with healthcare costs throughout our systems. We have not addressed healthcare.
Thank you so much for being here, Senator Lisa Murkowski. Next Tuesday is Election Day. Make sure you get out and vote. And we will not be talking about elections next Tuesday. We'll be talking with Dr. Alex Hills and his new book on connecting villages in the telecom system in rural Alaska. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Wesley Early on phones. Thanks to our listeners for joining us.
Made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, fueling philanthropic programs dedicated to creating educational and professional opportunities for Alaska Native people. And by From Military Might to Counterculture Cool to Camo Chic, camouflage in plain sight exposes the ancient yet modern art of concealment. See camouflage at the Anchorage Museum through February the 5th. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.